1930s brought to the world a popular music phenomenon called the Big Band Era. Large ensembles playing music that caught the imagination of dancers and serious listeners alike. Ballrooms and nightclubs from London to New York were packed with fans eager to hear their favorites. Lounge rooms filled with radio broadcasts of live performances. Movie houses offered big band entertainment in between films. A new invention, the jukebox, was just taking off and it was stocked with the latest hits. It was a moment in popular music history that has passed, but it will never be forgotten. Any discussion of an era inevitably leads to the subject of beginnings. When and where did it all start? Opinions vary, but it's generally agreed that the big band sound began to take shape towards the end of the 1920s with the experimentation of black musicians like Fletcher Henderson, Duke Ellington, and Benny Moten. Moten Kansas City Orchestra, and a 1928 recording of a tune called South. It's a chugging, embryonic example of the style that was to become so popular, but it was not to be instantaneous. While these black bands were beginning to utilize a new sound, it was impossible, given the racial climate in the U.S. at the time, that they could gain mass public appeal. For that to happen, the music would have to be played by white musicians. Realizing this, Glenn Gray and his Casa Loma Orchestra were among the first to record what is now regarded as a Duke Ellington classic. Thank you. The attraction of black jazz for the growing number of white musicians who wished to play in that style was obvious. It gave them room to improvise and experiment for themselves, free of the restrictions their own musical heritage placed on them. The whole scene was in a state of flux, and certainly no one could have foreseen an event that would affect the direction of popular music for the next 15 years. The Wall Street crash and the Great Depression.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee Doodle Dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember they called me Al? It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember I'm your pal? Buddy, can you spare a dime?
The early Depression years found every department of the entertainment industry concerned with survival rather than expansion. Record companies were badly hit. The worst year for record sales was 1932, when the total number sold throughout the U.S. was about 6 million, whereas in 1927, sales had reached 104 million. A number of prominent bands folded, and there was a decline in the emergence of new ones, yet surprisingly enough, perhaps many did find it possible to eke out a living. Part of the reason for this was the fact that the music helped the people forget the problems of everyday existence during such hard times.
Thank you.
As the 30s progressed, the popularity of the big bands grew. Homer Capehart from southern Indiana had invented and manufactured an automatic record changer that could be placed in the store, and you could hear your favorite tune simply by inserting a coin. Was born, and it quickly became a part of the American way of life. In this way, the record companies opened up whole new avenues of sales as these machines penetrated even the smallest rural communities. The end of the Prohibition days in 1933 was another large factor in that it altered the habits of a nation and deprived jazz musicians of their biggest potential source of employment, the speakeasies. By 1934, jazz had to find a new audience. This need was answered by a specially gifted young clarinetist, Benny Goodman. Tune that became a Benny Goodman trademark, Let's Dance. Goodman took big band music into whole new areas. The moment was ripe for a breakthrough from more adventurous leaders, and in this sense, Goodman's arrival on the scene was well-timed. In 1935, at the Palomar Ballroom in Hollywood, he found all the factors of what would become known as the swing age. Massed audiences, fans clustered around the bandstand, individual musicians recognized for their talents, and band leaders becoming brand names. If Goodman was doing the right thing at the right time in front of the right people, as Duke Ellington once said, he owed a lot to his new arranger at that time, black band leader Fletcher Henderson. His arrangements were unique, says Goodman. As for the origin of the term swing, he had this to say.
But I do know where the title swing came from, as far as I was concerned, because many years ago, all the bands had an extra title, like Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians, you know. Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians. Coon Sanderson and his Nighthawks, or something like that. So when my band started, it was just Benny Goodman and his band. They said, well, you can't have simply that. You must put something else. What else can it be? And I said, well, gee, I don't have the slightest idea. I think Gene Krupa at that time said, why don't you call it the swing band? We're always, it's what we play, you know. I thought, okay, that's it.
Goodman was the king of swing, a Hollywood film star, a millionaire, and an international celebrity. Naturally, others followed, among them Goodman's closest competitors, people like Artie Shore and Tommy Dorsey. This was a period when a new spirit of optimism was sweeping the U.S. Roosevelt was president, and a determined attempt was being made to break out of the Depression with his New Deal program. People were convinced that a better time was possible, here and now, and the big bands, in particular those playing swing, were offering that public music that was exciting, buoyant, and optimistic.
Thank you.
vivid, liquid sound of Artie Shaw and his orchestra with Begin the Begin, originally cut as the B-side of another disc. It became one of the best-known arrangements of swing. The big bands were riding the crest of a wave, and this newfound popularity saw the emergence, from nearly all the well-known bands, of personality soloists. When the fans went to hear Benny Goodman, for instance, they expected soloists like Harry James, Ziggy Elman, Gene Krupa to be well-featured. And in due course, many of these musicians formed their own bands. Among the best known of the second wave of band leaders were people like Lionel Hampton, Harry James, and Bunny Berrigan. event that came to be regarded as the peak of the swing era for the big bands came in 1938. Benny Goodman gathered his orchestra and a few friends, which included people like Count Basie, Teddy Wilson, and the Andrews Sisters, and did what was rare for a dance band in those days. They gave a legitimate concert at Carnegie Hall. As it was, the Carnegie Hall concert proved one thing. Swing had become so popular that it had sold out to commerciality. As Artie Shaw once said, when you start making music into a commodity and selling it to the masses, then you've lost something very precious. Swing became just another of the labels given to the mass market of popular music. Within months of the Carnegie Hall concert, the scene began to change. One extreme example was Artie Shaw himself, who left the stage in the middle of an engagement and lit off for a holiday in Mexico and never came back. But while swing was dying, big band popularity was far from over. On radio, the major cigarette companies scrambled to sign up bands for their sponsored shows. Each network fought for the right to broadcast hotel and ballroom performances, and the record industry had never seen a boom like it. In 1941, one record topped the million sales mark.
I want to present Mr. W. Wallace Early, the manager of record sales for Victor and Bluebird Records. Mr. Early.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. And speaking for RCA Victor, we're mighty proud of that Chattanooga choo-choo and the man who made the record, Glenn Miller. You see, it's been a long time, 15 years, in fact, since any record has sold a million copies. And Chattanooga choo-choo certainly put on steam and breezed right through that million mark by over 200,000 pressings. And we decided that Glenn should get a trophy. The best one we could think of was a gold record of Chattanooga. And now, Glenn, it's yours, with the best wishes of RCA Victor Bluebird Records.
Well, thank you, Wally. That's really a wonderful present.
I think everyone listening in on the radio should know, Glenn, it actually is a recording of Chattanooga Choo Choo, but it's in gold, solid gold, and it's really fine.
That's right, Paul. And now for the boys in the band and for the whole gang, thanks 1,200,000.
That's nicely put, Glenn, and I know that our sponsors are mighty proud of that record, too. So now, suppose we enjoy you and the boys playing what's on that gold record. Chattanooga Choo Choo.
No leader in the world of dance music has created a style that's retained its appeal for as long as Glenn Miller's. Over 30 years after his death, the mystique that surrounds his name and his music remains as potent as ever. Also, at this time, many black musicians were gaining the recognition due to them. Jimmy Lunsford and his orchestra were in their prime at the stage, and Duke Ellington had a huge hit with a tune called Take the A-Train. Duke Ellington.
Take the A-Train? Oh, Billy Strayhorn wrote it. Yes, Billy Strayhorn. That was the big number, 1941 in California. And then along came the ASCAP BMI war, and I couldn't play my own music on the air, so I had these other people who didn't belong to ASCAP to writing. I had Teasel writing, my son writing, and Strayhorn writing, and that was the foundation of our music firm, because it all went in there. And the firm of Tempo Music at that time didn't belong to ASCAP, and it didn't belong to BMI, didn't belong to anything. It was just an independent firm. And then after the war was over, then they joined ASCAP, you know.
Hit, and the same year Glenn Miller received the Gold Record Award for Chattanooga, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
America's involvement in the war hit the entertainment industry hard. Many band members were either drafted or volunteered for military service. The United States government ordered a cut in record production of some 70% because it used shellac, a vital item in war production. The companies decided then to concentrate on the best-selling commercial bands, which were dominated by Glenn Miller, of course, but also the Dorsey brothers, Jimmy and Tommy. Tommy Dorsey in Opus 1 from 1944. Writer George T. Simon described Tommy's orchestra as the greatest all-round dance band of them all. Again, times were hard, and again the music of the day was used by the public as an escape to make them think of happier days ahead, or for some as the only link they had with home.
For the top tunes on your Red Hot and Blue Tune Parade, it's Sound Off! Welcome, gang. Come right in and take your customary seats while we proudly present your favorite four. This is Leaping Johnny Lansing, standing right here and telling you that we've got quite a lineup today. It may be a little vocal, but that's balanced off by some very fine blues that are coming right up. In fact, the agenda fixes it, so you'll get the full treatment. It took some mail to order up this first melody, but the gang in New Caledonia did it.
Was quick and slick. How about you fellas giving us something to remember? Something like an order for your favorite tune. All you have to do is write the Sound Off, Armed Forces Radio, Los Angeles, USA. And when you do, will you let us know whether you hear this program by shortwave or over your local station? Thanks, Yanks. Attention, men, we now present the pewter pin. The award for the nicest letter of the day goes to Sergeant Johnny Jones and the gang at APO 980. Thank you, gang, and here's your sound-off special. Lionel Hampton playing Shoo Shoo Baby, Dinah Washington rocks the cradle.
Mighty fine bands on the old beaten-down stand this trip. A canary or so who can really make you feel it right down to your toes. The riffs will rally in Hot Horn Alley. And if you're set, here they come. Number four on your Red Hot and Blue Tune Parade. The big order came in from the Gates and the Solomons. They picked A. Dilly, the tune Old Man River, and the knocked-out music of Stan Kenton's band. Kenton has one of the finest bands wrecking the walls these days. And there they are, gang, the four tunes you ordered on your Red Hot and Blue Tune Parade. And you know, every day, this old bounce barometer of ours changes according to your taste in popular music. So if you can, slip your order in the mail right now. It'll be filled faster than you can leap in a Jeep. And here's a big special invitation for you all to be around the next time we get in the saddle to sound off. Until we chop sticks together again, the best of the best to y'all. This is Boots Barnett slipping the solid signature on another Sound Off produced for the Armed Forces Radio Service.
Though the American band leaders and musicians were never forced to endure the bombing attacks on their home territory like their British counterparts, they did have problems at home nonetheless. The fight between the two music controllers, ASCAP and BMI, developed because many radio stations did not have a license to broadcast live music, so they played records. Believing that the musicians had a right to collect a fee on every disc that was played, their union called a strike. Although this was against the wishes of most of the band leaders, they were forbidden to enter recording studios from August 1942. Consequently, the record companies called upon the only musicians who weren't in the union, the singers. By the time the strike ended over a year later, these vocalists had gained a strong foothold. Some of the band survived, but by 1946 there were many warning signs that all was not well, and late that year Benny Goodman, Woody Herman, Tommy Dorsey, Harry James and Les Brown all disbanded in a single month. Signaled the end of an era that represented a high point in popular entertainment, and it's probably best summed up in the words of a leading writer on the bands, Albert McCarthy. He said, "Primarily, they, that is the bands, regarded themselves as entertainers, but entertainers whose tradition embraced a concern with craftsmanship and inventiveness. Their days of glory are long past, but the best of their music has acquired the timeless character of all that is best in popular art."
I've been dancing since I'm 17 years old. And in New York here, we had all these here taxi dance halls and things like that. And when we got a new band like Benny Goodman or something like that, we never missed the opportunity to go. The Paramount, the Roxy Theater, the Capitol. There'd be three or four bands and it'd all keep playing. All, you know, just as soon as one stopped, the other one would start. When the dance was the Peabody, the One Step, Black Bottom, Big Apple, the Balconades, the Charleston. In those days, we used to hold our partners in our arms, you know, where today you don't even touch them. Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and Prohibition. Yes, it was quite a time.
Popping up soda pop brickies to our heart's delight.
Dance to swingaroo quickies, jukebox Saturday night.
To make things bright.
Flicks and hot flicks of vanilla, jukebox Saturday night. They put nothing past us,
me and Honey Lane.
Making one coat last us till it's time to scram. Money we really don't need that.
We'll make out all right.
Let me out the guy feed that jukebox Saturday.
Sipping a soda, we got a scheme. Somebody else plays the record machine. It's so easy to say pet names when you listen to the trumpet of Harry
James.
Why the
Now, you listen here to me, honey child, if I didn't know. All of them little things I'm supposed to know. Then I sure would be a sad man.
Sentimental Journey, the story of the big band era, was narrated by Mike Jeffries and produced by Tony Rasmussen, with special thanks to Gene Walker of ABC Radio Archives. ABC Radio 1 and Radio 3.